Welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude, your pop culture and comic book podcast, coming to you from the megacity metropolis of Toronto. I am your host, Eric Anthony, and for this episode, I'm very, very happy to have back to the show two friends of the show, friends of mine, and two of the masterminds behind the Cauldron Anthology magazine. I'm sure you guys have heard us talk about it plenty of times on this show. It's none other than Sam Noir and Casey Parsons. Welcome back, guys, and thank you for visiting the cave again.
Thank you for having us.
There you are.
Delighted to be here, my friend.
So just a disclaimer, everybody listening, we can't see each other right now. We're doing this over Skype. So at times, if it comes off a little choppy or if there's some type of interruption, no, we're not purposely being rude to each other. And bear with us because we're going to have a lot of fun with this episode. But before we get this show on the road, how are both of you guys doing? First, we'll start with Casey. Casey, what's new and exciting in your life, and how are you doing in this new normal that we're living in?
Well, I don't know about new and exciting so much. Things are on hold. I've just been kind of taking care of myself and staying really busy with art commissions and trying to work on my own little projects on the side if I can find the time. But, the world's on hold, really, so... Just kind of waiting for things to get back to normal, but otherwise good, really good.
That's good.
Thank you for asking.
Sam, how about you? How are you doing, buddy?
Not too bad, all things considering. I had basically, on the suggestion of our good friend Shane, I started tabling at Raid Studios just before the pandemic hit. And then, once we were into the lockdown, I was actually... just to keep myself a little structured. Everyone else had sort of left the studio. So, I've been coming in every day to a big empty studio, really bonding with the other studio mate that was also joining Raid at the same time, a gentleman by the name of Andrew Dorland. And the upshot of, I guess sheltering together in the studio, we managed to come up with a brand new comics project, which is going to be launching on Kickstarter, hopefully within the next week or two. It's called Ballyskillen. It's a contemporary fantasy comic book series. But the most exciting part about this is there's an augmented reality component to it, where we have an app on your phone or your tablet, and using your camera on your device, it enhances the story using animation, traditional 2D animation. It's quite innovative, and I'm excited to share that with the world soon.
That's awesome. That's really exciting. So do you have a estimated date of when it will launch and when people can look out for it?
Our beta app the Android app is already... up on the Android store, and we're just waiting for the Apple app to go up on the iOS store. And once we get some friends testing it to make sure it works, if all goes right, next week at some point we'll launch.
Excellent. That's fantastic. It's good to see that all the creative people are staying in a creative space. And you know, sometimes the bad things that are happening around us force us into situations that sometimes really creative things happen. And you, like you just said, you know, you tabling at Raid during this current situation made this happen, which may not have otherwise come together in the same way. I mean, it could have, but it's always good to see good things come out of sad situations. So that's great, Sam. That's really exciting.
Yeah, it was amazing. Just even having the structure of like getting up every day. You know, I mean, the subways were basically empty every day, which was, you know, pretty safe, all things considering. And I'd come into the studio, and the other two gentlemen in the studio were pretty far apart. And during that time, I managed to write, I think, 100 pages of script.
Great. That's excellent. Wow. In a couple of weeks, we would normally have been meeting together at Fan Expo Canada, which is not going to be happening this year. Do you guys miss the con circuit? Are you looking forward to it coming back? How are you guys feeling about all of that stuff?
I'm definitely missing the con atmosphere. It's usually a crazy, hard-working weekend, but it's so much fun and so great to socialize with, you know, other people, friends and artists in the industry. And, you know, it's a great gathering spot and meeting, you know, clients that you've had before and friends. And even besides Fan Expo, like I was going to be traveling the world basically doing cons, so I'm kind of missing that and missing my Kirby's Comic Art group. We were going to be heading to Switzerland and London and back to Italy, and so I was lucky to have made it to Chicago and Italy earlier this year, so I'm thankful for that, but definitely missing hanging out with great comic people.
Yeah. How about you, Sam?
I'll be honest, just because, you know me, I've been basically doing shows, like multiple shows sometimes, every single week for years now. And you know how hard I work doing three sketches for the kids at these shows. Often I lose my voice within 2 or 3 days of these shows. So yeah, I've actually kind of enjoyed having the time off, to be honest. Although, I do... Now that we've had all this time off, I am looking forward to the day when we can get back to doing shows, and hopefully, again, I'll do less shows. Has always been my goal, but yeah, Fan Expo is certainly something we're missing this year.
Yeah.
I got to say, I felt the same. Like it was great having that kind of breather at the beginning. It was almost a break. And I thought, oh, we're going to have all this free time and I can just get all this work done. And it was great at the beginning, but now it's like the social aspect I'm missing. And there's also the financial side of it too, where some of these weekends are very profitable for, you know, us freelancing artists.
Absolutely.
So missing that kind of hurts a bit too.
Yeah. Well, depending on how things shake out this fall, especially with the new volume of Cauldron. Well, we still have the volume that volume 3, now known as Spring 2020. that was supposed to launch at Toronto Comic Con. We've just finished fulfilling the Kickstarter for that. Casey and I spent a day last week just stuffing envelopes, and he was nice enough to drive all the way in from the Hamilton Stony Creek area. And that's nice to get that out of the way. And then, we likely would have been, there is Fan Expo limited edition that is planned for November.
Right.
And so the tentative plan, whether it happens, we don't know. Whether the province will allow it to happen, but we are planning on launching our fourth Kickstarter for Cauldron in September with the plan that we would launch at that show. And failing that, I think they're also considering a smaller show in December. And again, this is speculation on my part, but the Christmas Fan Expo show is always much smaller, and if they can... keep it to whatever phase, what's phase 4? Gatherings of no more than 500?
I'm not sure.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
It may depend on the area, too.
The situation is so unpredictable, and it's changing day by day. You know, you never know when, hot, quote-unquote, hot spots are going to flare up. So we can plan for it, but we're not necessarily, We won't be absolutely heartbroken if it doesn't happen. It's better that everyone stays safe and everything, all in good time. And this is the great thing about Kickstarter. We can reach our audience.
Right.
Literally, you know, folks that want Cauldron can get it. And we're also doing a series of small signings, hopefully in the fall. Again, the situation changes all the time, but our plan is we owe Kingston at the very least a signing, and once the front area Raid has a coffee shop and gallery space, so I think we're going to be planning a signing and Kickstarter pickup for the previous volume 3 within the next little while as well. So be on the lookout. We'll announce that once plans are firmer.
That's great. Yeah.
Also, Raid is selling our Cauldron magazine on their website. And we're going to try and hit as many comic stores as we can, as Sam says, when things open up a little bit more. And we've started actually dropping books off already, like only to a couple spots, like our very close stores, like our own stores. We're going to try and hit, Thunderstruck and then Comic One Books in Stony Creek, which is, I'm a partner there. But we're going to try and hit as many stores as we can and try and get reach the people as much as we can. And Kickstarter, like our people have been, our audience and clientele has been really great and understanding with, and as they know, like we've been dying to get this issue out into people's hands. It was already delayed and we pushed. Mm-hmm. We knew COVID was coming. We were trying to get it printed and out before it happened and it just was impossible. So we've been scrambling and trying to meet when we can and get this out to everybody safely and timely. But just appreciate everybody's understanding and patience with this. And for the next issue coming out, we'll be back on track.
Yeah.
And it's looking, shaping up really well.
Yeah, two issues a year was our initial plan. And again, we got set back a little, but actually I'm really excited. I got a message today containing a layout from Casey. So this is going to be the first time I get to collaborate with Casey. So I'm super excited about that.
Oh, that's great. Perfect. Yeah, that's really exciting. Good job, guys.
Yeah, we like changing hats. It's kind of fun. I'm writing a script for Jonathan Kochuba for this next issue. And it's been great working with him. Yeah.
His stuff looks fantastic. His design work is amazing. Jonathan's at another level right now.
He's doing incredible stuff.
You can see during this time off, he's just been churning out pages and being really productive. Who else is in this issue? Dwyer.
Nice.
Yep. Dwyer's turned in his pages, and they're all amazing. Daniel Wong is part of I knew Daniel from Ty Templeton's Comic Book Workshop, and he's doing amazing stuff as well.
We've got a cover by Paul Lemjanka, which is just phenomenal.
I saw that. That's out of control, that thing.
Yeah, you may have seen that on you probably saw that on the Fastball special Sketchomania.
That's right.
But even his preliminary sketch, his colored painting, if you can call it a sketch, I mean,
yeah, it looks like
it should have been the cover too.
Yeah, he sent us a quote unquote sketch, which looked like a fully finished painting.
Yeah, his style is just like what he does and how he makes that picture looks like it popping out of the page. It's just incredible. It's really cool.
And our first variant cover as well. He's modified it slightly, so for as a Kickstarter exclusive, there's going to be a surprise variant,
awesome.
Shall we say.
Awesome.
A and B cover. Yeah.
That's very cool. It seems like with this pandemic and what it's done to businesses and business models, that we're about to face a very, like a changing of the guard, if you will, especially with all the news of what's happening at DC Comics, for instance. So it looks like there's no shortage of creators and ideas and people coming up with things, but I think the way the business functions is going to be different. So it's good to see no shortage of creativity coming from guys such as yourself and all of the artists you mentioned. So that'll be fun to see how things shape up in the next couple of months and years.
Well, the online tools are incredible. Like Zoom has really sort of become kind of a game changer. We've always had these tools, but the pandemic sort of forced us to use it in our toolbox. So for example, not for this upcoming issue, but for the first issue in 2021, Paul is actually going to be doing interior pages, painted interior pages. And as you know, Paul lives in Thailand. Mm-hmm. And just being able to work with Paul over Zoom on the other side of the world, other than the time difference, like figuring out, you know, when he's awake and I'm awake to chat, it's quite astonishing to me that, you know, we can be collaborating quite closely just over Zoom while he's in the other side of the planet.
Yeah. It's about 11 hour time difference or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's great, guys.
That's true, too. There's been online cons now. I've been part of a couple of those. Like, it seems like that might be the new norm, is doing these sort of Zoom interactions and online convention groups and things.
Yeah. I have to say, the one thing that I love about being in Toronto is just how many pros there are, you know, that we can meet up together. And I miss being able to meet up with you guys in person the way we were able to before all of this happened. So that's the one thing I do look forward to, hopefully changing soon, that we can meet up again, have a drink, record a pod. Because, I mean, we could do all these things over Zoom, which is wonderful that we can still do this, but I do miss being able to see all of you guys in person, because that's, like I said, it's the one special thing about being in Toronto, right? But soon. Well,
that's the one thing I really miss about Fan Expo, our after party, usually at the Lucky Clover, where we just all go over there and hang out as a community and relax after the show, have a drink, kick back, great conversations.
Right. Yeah, it's true.
I like being in Stony Creek because there's no competition around, you know. I'm kind of the lone wolf here, I think. There's a few guys in Hamilton, but...
Right. So...
I'm just kidding. No, I'd love to be social and see everybody again.
Yeah. No, it'll happen soon, I'm sure. I think everyone is itching for it to happen, too. So once we get, like you said, maybe the Stage 4 green light, it'll... Maybe people's comfort level or... you know, willingness to want to meet up might, you know, happen again. But anyways, for this episode, Sam hit me up with the idea because he's listened to the episodes with Casey and he's heard you guys talk about your love of the Hulk, the Incredible Hulk, the Immortal Hulk. And he said he would love to do a top five Hulk stories with Casey Parsons. So I said, let me try to organize this and we could have some fun. Now, disclaimer, it's going to be you two schooling me on the Hulk, because I have read the Hulk, but I don't know it well enough, I don't feel, to give a top five of my own. So I want you guys to direct me to the stories that you think I would enjoy. So I'll moderate it, but this is the Casey and Sam show from here on out.
Okay, but even we would love to hear at some point during this conversation what your personal, even if you haven't read
sure,
a lot of them,
absolutely.
If you have any favorites as well. But I'm sure there's going to be a lot of overlap as well. And just like our epic, crazy top Spider-Man conversations with Kevin Boyd, I do have my top five, but then I've kind of extended it to a lot of honorable mentions, which hopefully we can just sort of call out rather than go into huge depth with them. I know we have limited time, and last time we talked about Spider-Man, they were, you know, kicking us out of restaurants and polishing the floors in the mall as we were discussing it. So,
well,
we may need a part two and three.
Yeah, maybe.
I want to say that I'm awful at picking favorites. I kind of dislike picking favorites. I'm hoping to also kind of get into a bit of the psychology of the character and, mm-hmm. and the meaning of the character and the mythos of the Hulk. Well, I don't know if they call us Hulkophiles. I don't know if that sounds like we inappropriately touch Hulks, or if there's another appropriate name for that. Like if you're Hulk fanatic or something. Or
do we want to start there in terms of what the appeal is? I know
absolutely.
Both Casey and I are
how we got into the Hulk.
Yes, absolutely. Both of you, give me your connection to the Hulk. What was it about that character? Maybe the first memory you have of the character, or when you fell in love with the Hulk.
You're doing great with questions already. Oh. I mean, I think this will be more interesting than just saying I like this. Like, if we get into a little bit more deeper.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have an intelligent audience. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I'm into. Of course, the psychology behind it all.
You want to go first, Sam?
No, actually, I'll let you go first, just because I know it really impacted you quite a lot as a child.
Yeah. Okay. Like Hulk, if you know me, and if you've known me for a while, and the connection to comics, Incredible Hulk is my guy. Like that's what got me into comics. I think it even helped started me drawing. even though I was kind of doing art a little before that. But I was fairly young. I was about 2.5. We would go to my father's parents' house, my grandparents' house, and they were on the kind of Stony Creek Mountain, and we'd usually play in the basement. And if we were there late enough in the evenings, the TV would be on while we're playing downstairs, and there wasn't a lot to do. But my brother and sister would be there, and my cousin. And the French channel would be on showing the Hulk. Like, they were flipping around, and we saw this green monster on the TV, right? And I was like, what's this? You know, like, I want to see this, you know. It was in French, but I didn't care. And the Hulk wasn't saying anything, so it didn't really matter. Just kind of growling and throwing people. And, you know, he's standing there in his ripped pants and shirtless and his crazy hair and his big nose and everything. That was the Lou Ferrigno show, right? The yep. Kenneth Johnson Incredible Hulk series. So it was L'Incroyable Hulk, you know. And I didn't know French, and I was asking my sister, translate this for me. And, you know, she struggled. You know, she tried. But that kind of got me into it. That was the start. I mean, seeing that, and it was scary in a way. You know, I was pretty young, so I didn't really understand. But I just saw this thing, you know. And I didn't know why I gravitated towards it. I think I liked the color green. I liked this idea. This thing was just, I think I had a little bit of a temper too that I inherited. And I could see that. It's just like he got angry and then you have all the strength to kind of let it out. Mm-hmm. But he didn't hurt. Like, he didn't hurt people. He wasn't, I mean, he hurt them, but he wasn't like, you know, killing, or it was, you know, injuring people that kind of deserved it or asking for it in a way.
Right.
And
right.
Bill Bixby, I was sort of pitied him and Bill, you know, I always pitied his version of Bruce Banner or David Banner on the show. Anyhow, I just wanted to start collecting the Hulk. I was drawing him, and I wanted to just have everything Hulk from there. So even by the time I was 3, I already was starting a good collection. It was my first comic, which I got beside me, actually, was the Rampaging Hulk series when it changed into, they just started calling it the Hulk, the big magazine from the late 70s. And it was issue 11, and it was like the first one in color. It's just phenomenal. It's like Ernie Chan's art in there, and he's fighting this strong man that's wearing this exoskeleton, and they're like, you know, throwing a roller coaster around in there. Some great, great pinups and splash pages.
That fascinates me that your first Hulk comic was actually the magazine, which was aimed at a slightly older teen, if not adult, audience.
I think there was just still that stigma that, like, comics are just for kids. So there wasn't really any, I think they knew if they saw like heavy metal or something, they might want to look inside and go, what's this? But, you know, they know it's a Marvel character, and I think they felt quite safe. Like, my mom, I should say, felt quite safe getting that for me and thought, you know, I'd just enjoy it. And it was like anything that was getting us reading. So she was very good that way. Like, just like if we were reading, good. And comics did that, right? Like, and I also grabbed Hulk novels I couldn't read just because I loved the covers and Hulk was on it. And I would try to get my brother to read some to me, and I was trying to teach myself to read actually through Hulk novels. I just pick out the Hulk and read little sections and try and figure things out. And then I had a Defenders issue, and Hulk is on one of those sort of torture, I don't know what they're called, Man of War torture things or whatever. It was just an excellent cover of him kind of unconscious, hung up on this, like kind of crucified on this torture device, old Defenders issue. And then I started getting, a couple of different ways. I went to, I'll try and keep this short. I know I'm kind of droning on.
No, this is good.
So there was a flea market, and this is like my first interaction with Tom Lang, who I'll get to later, but... So he had this little kiosk in a flea market down in Stony Creek. I think it was off of like number 8 highway on Queenston there. And we would, you know, I was in the stroller still, and I would actually, you know, see him right down the aisle. He was kind of right at an intersection when you went into this little mall, this little like weekend flea market thing. And I would go right there, and I'd jump out of the stroller and climb under the table and start digging through his boxes and picking out Rampaging Hulk issues that he had. And Tom was so good. He was just quiet. He knew I was there, and he liked it, you know. He just liked the enthusiasm, and he was helpful and courteous, and just, I don't think he knew what to make of children, but as long as you weren't, like, wrecking anything, it was fine. And then it ended up, years later, like, as he was sort of touring different flea markets, he worked in Eastgate very briefly, and another Queenston mall, which is another area in Hamilton there. And eventually he opened Comic One Books in the mid-80s, and I started getting my Hulk comics there. But just before then, I was ordering Hulk issues in the mail. And I was just telling Sam about this. My first Hulk issue I got in the mail was number 286. And that ended up being a very controversial issue. It was Bill Mantlo, wasn't it, Sam?
Yeah.
There's a good story behind that issue. I mean, that could almost be a whole other podcast, but basically Bill Mantlo stole a Harlan Ellison story that he had written for, I think, an Outer Limits episode, something about a soldier, and he was like from the year 2041 coming back in time or something. He had this big gun and whatever, like futuristic technology. And Bill Mantlo just thought, hey, that's a good idea. I'll just make it a Hulk story. And of course, Jim Shooter's the editor at the time, just thinks, oh, Bill Mantlo's like really, you know, his writing's really improved all of a sudden. And then he gets a call, you know, once Hulk hits the shelves, somebody called him and said, oh, do you know what you've done? You've ripped off Harlan Ellison. Like, there's no credit in there. And then the story goes, I guess, that Harlan Ellison called him right after and said, you know, and Jim Shooter admitted to it and he was apologetic, but Harlan just basically said, you've ripped off one of my stories and, you know, didn't give me credit or ask permission or whatever. And at the time, Harlan could have asked for a lot, like, you know, like a $100,000 lawsuit kind of thing.
Just like he for the same story, he also sued James Cameron, the movie Terminator, which is also loosely based on that and another short story that was adapted as an Outer Limits episode.
Wow.
So it ended up Harlan Ellison just said, like, well, I just want an apology in the comic. I want to get paid whatever Bill Mantlo got paid for writing that issue. And I want a free Marvel Comics subscription for life. And it was like done and done.
And he was a big comic book fan, Harlan Ellison.
Yeah. And I think he ended up writing a whole story or two, I think, later on. But
These accusations of plagiarism will also be revisited later on. I'll talk about it when we start on our top Hulk stories list. But there's another famous example of Mantlo being accused of taking a story that wasn't his.
Yeah.
Oh, that's too bad.
Anyhow, I've got a complete run from there on, and I filled in some gaps, earlier gaps.
This is what's fascinating to me, Casey. I didn't know this. The fact that those early comic issues of the Hulk are directly tied in with a gentleman, which I guess you've said has been a little bit of a mentor to you in comics, and now you own Comics One, or you're part owner of Comics One. That the same proprietor owned, that sold you these early Rampaging Hulk magazines.
So Comic One Books, opened in Stony Creek, mid-80s. Tom Lang is the owner, and he passed away in 2013. And then me and a couple of guys, like, it was still our kind of little haven, and Tom stayed, you know, I was very close friends with him, and we stayed in touch. I worked for him for years. Like, once high school kind of came around, I started working in the store and managing and not knowing anything and not knowing what I was doing, but I loved it. And he treated me really well. And he was a mentor. Like, he was a very brilliant guy. He was a very patient, very deep thinker, very good speaker, very good writer. Like, he could have been a novelist easily, but I think he was too, just like self-deprecating that way. Like, he just didn't have he'd be like too nervous to do it almost. But he loved the medium of comics. Like, he just appreciated always the underdogs and art and writing and this weird medium. You know, he found it very attractive. And he didn't know a ton about comics, but he loved the medium as well. But I started drawing, of course, right away, and I was bringing him like Hulk drawings, and he'd pin them up on the wall. And he remembers, like, he always talked about this one I brought in early on. Like, I was probably like 7 or something like that. I don't know, maybe a little later. It could have been 8 or 9, because I'm not sure the exact year now. But it was like right when he opened, basically. And I brought in this drawing of the
like when the Great Hulk just started out. And I did this Great Hulk drawing. And it was probably based on, you know, something McFarlane was doing. You know, I was pretty young. I don't know. Probably not seven. It's hard. It's all kind of a blur, but I remember more like kind of the feelings and the imagery and the artists more than, you know, exact details, but yeah. But he always appreciated that and encouraged it, and I kept bringing him art, and eventually he hired me. I was only about 16, I think, when I started working there. It was a lot of fun.
That's awesome.
And I started collecting everything else.
Yeah, that's what usually happens, especially when you
start following, this is comics, you know.
When you start following an artist, and if it was McFarlane at the time, and then he moves from that to Spider-Man, it's just like a natural thing to collect everything after a while. How about you, Sam? What was your introduction to the Hulk?
Well, given the fact that you went through 3 hours plus of conversation about Spider-Man, you know that Spider-Man's my guy, but Hulk comes pretty close. And again, it's not as vivid as Casey in terms of my first Hulk encounters, but I do have a few early memories, one of which is the Mego Hulk action figure. For me, that really sort of stood out, and he was so much different than the other Mego action figures. He even had a very unique muscular body as well. So I had that toy very, very early. I probably had like Spider-Man, Superman, Batman, and then, at some point, the Hulk entered my early toy, my love of toys, and it's still one of my cherished toys to this day. Even with my childhood one has a broken knee, he still sits on my shelf. The earliest Hulk comic I can remember, and it could have even been like a hand-me-down or a used comic, is I vividly remember it still had that still only 35 cents burst on it, and Hulk was fighting a bad guy called Tyrannus, I think, who was in a large metal tower. And yeah, I again, this is me learning to read through comics, but it really struck me how different the Hulk was, especially once I saw the Hulk. There were two different versions of Hulk on TV. The first was on, I want to say it's probably either the Multicultural or the French channel that had the 19th, that was playing reruns, not in English, at like 6 in the morning of the 1960s Hulk cartoon, where they simply animated Jack Kirby panels. Like they move his mouth or just slide the figure across. It had a very memorable theme song. I'm sure you can look up on YouTube. But it really was the Hulk sort of come to life. And of course, Lou Ferrigno, once he entered. And I do remember I was allowed to stay up late on nights that the Hulk, just to watch the Hulk. And I just, even you can see the appeal as a kid and why his appeal is so primal to even the youngest kids, because, you know, one of your earliest emotions is frustration and anger, and even the Hulk being sort of monosyllabic, that miscommunication or difficulty communicating. I think there is something very, very specific about the Hulk and young children, particularly him being a bit of a monster as well as a superhero.
Yeah, I had the same experience. My earliest memory of the Hulk was the television show as well. I must have been maybe 5 or 6 years old when I think they were playing, at the time, it was the made-for-TV movie, the one that would have featured, I think, the Daredevil. Were the Daredevil and Thor in the same?
They were separate. That was Trial of the Incredible Hulk. Right. And was it Rex Smith? I think it was Rex Smith that played Daredevil in a more ninja costume that would, I feel like, inform the Netflix, the first season of the Netflix show.
Yeah, also
it wasn't too terrible.
No, it wasn't.
A couple special effects were bad. There was a flying car scene that was just
atrocious, but
and but great.
Daredevil's pretty good. Yeah,
John Rhys Davies as the Kingpin.
Yeah. And it was. It also reminded me of the Daredevil Man Without Fear, John Romita Jr. costume design. I feel like it was very similar to that as well. The one from the TV show that you mentioned with Rex Smith. But I think it was that episode, and the first time I saw the Hulk transform was that scene where he was in the train fighting the thugs in the train. I don't know if you guys remember which one I'm talking about. It was at the very beginning of the episode, and I missed the rest of it because I fell asleep. It was late at night, and my parents were watching it. But it was, I didn't know what they were watching. At first, it seemed boring, but they were like, this is a superhero movie or a superhero show. Like, you'll like it. Just watch a little bit. And at first, I was terrified, but you also realize that, yeah, this is very comic book-like. And I remember watching repeatedly the death of the Hulk made-for-TV movie,
yeah.
Which didn't really make sense that he died that way. But as a kid, I mean, you didn't ask those type of questions. I wasn't quite as in tune with all of the plot holes, perhaps. But it was a TV show for me as well. Lou Ferrigno was the Hulk in my mind. So that dichotomy of a superhero also being a monster and something to be afraid of was always very interesting to me about the character.
And as 1970s television, it's still, you know, holds up relatively well. If you, I recently watched a few reruns. I found them online somewhere. But yeah, it's essentially taking the formula of The Fugitive, mm-hmm. the old TV show, and inserting a monster, the Hulk, twice before the first commercial break, he usually hulked out, or the second commercial break, and then at the finale of the episode.
Yeah, it was very formulaic, but it was well written. Yeah.
And Bill Bixby just brought a real, he's a great actor, and just brought a real gravitas, you know. I think Richard Donner described wanting Superman to have verisimilitude, if I pronounce that correctly. And I think as ludicrous as the concept could be, Bixby really sold it.
Yeah, it's true. And it was definitely ahead of its time, being one of the first respectable things as far as comic adaptations were concerned, especially for Marvel. Like, it took them a while to get something right again. But that was one of those first things that left an indelible mark on people's memory of what the Hulk was, for sure.
They reached a wide audience, too, because I think there were, like middle-aged women were kind of had a thing for Bill Bixby. You know, he was a good actor, right? Like you say, he brought that emotional content. Kenneth Johnson was the director of those, and they changed the origin just like to try and bring more emotional, like bring more pathos to the character, like by having it where his wife died and he didn't have the strength to save her, instead of, you know, saving the teenager on the test field of the bomb.
Mm.
So it was like, and there was always this kind of real sadness with him. Like, he could never keep a friend or a lover or anything, or stay at one spot. Cause it was always this thing hounding him, or on like the monkey on his back, basically the green monkey.
The iconography of you know, the theme song, that wonderful like piano as he's, you know, hitchhiking often in the rain, you know, in torn clothes. Yeah. Like they're really, you really did feel for the guy. Or beautifully shot that moment where he was trying to save his wife and couldn't. That was real motivation.
Yeah, that pilot episode is exceptional. So that song is called The Lonely Man by Joe Harnell. If you need any of these facts, let me know. I've got it all.
Now, were you guys ever a little upset that he didn't talk, the Hulk didn't talk? Because you mentioned the Defenders, and that was one of my favorite comics as a kid in terms of this. I always loved the Hulk's, the childlike Hulk interacting with the other superheroes. I like that dynamic, and I always wanted him to be able to sort of, you know, as a kid, this is from a kid's point of view, it's like if he could only talk and communicate and let people know, like in the comic book, that he's not that bad and he's only trying to help.
Right. He's constantly misunderstood because you're judging the book by its cover, right? You're seeing this monster first, and it's scary, right? You're seeing this big, green, muscular, angry-looking thing.
I got to be honest, I didn't really read too much of the Defenders. Like, I was allowed to collect the Hulk, and just starting out, I just grabbed Defenders because it was there in a variety store or something. But so I didn't read too many of those. I jumped right into the regular Hulk series. But it didn't bother me. No, I just, you just always kind of felt bad for Hulk and felt bad for Banner for different reasons. Hmm. Yeah. Like, I'm tempted to kind of get into kind of like the, you know, it's like there's the tropes, right? There's the archetypes that the Hulk is. Like, and I think Stanley and Jack the Kirby would have.
Frankenstein and the Jekyll
exactly,
and Hyde.
Yeah. Very Jekyll and Hyde.
Yeah.
And he's Frankenstein in a sense, more of the mechanics, like the looks, you know, the green and the hair and the fact that he's this, you know, he scares people and he doesn't mean to hurt anybody, but he does. And then the village wants to, you know, mm-hmm. burn their torches and chase him, right, and destroy him. Same kind of thing, right? Thunderbolt Ross kind of represents that, you know, the god of war sort of thing going after Hulk. And Hulk is really an innocent, sort of pure being, right? He just wants to be left alone. He just wants to sit in nature. Like, he gets along with children and women usually and animals and just wants to be find peace, right? He wants to find peace. It's a war and peace story.
We were in the car last week, and I think you mentioned the whole Frankenstein scene with the little girl.
Yeah.
The misunderstanding, I mean, there.
Yeah, how, like, that's a very powerful scene, right? Like, you think of even Lenny and Mice and Men, where he's petting the rabbit, right? And you go, like, you know he didn't mean to kill the rabbit. It was just he doesn't know his own strength. You know, he's innocent in a sense, right? Like, he's doesn't know any better, and the Hulk doesn't know any better. It's amazing he has as much control as he does.
Mm-hmm. Did you guys read this week's issue of the Immortal Hulk, by the way?
No, I haven't.
It just came out on Wednesday?
Yeah, yeah.
No, I read the last one, but not
without giving too much away, this is always
I know who's coming.
This has always been the trope of the Hulk, this whole, you know, misunderstanding. Like, he, whenever he finds acceptance, it's always sort of you know, misunderstanding always happens, right? And he's so childlike that he ends up on the outside. They've managed to twist that trope wonderfully. Yeah. They worked it, you know, to the point where you are, again, I thought, I've seen this so many times, how can it still be affecting me emotionally this way? Like, but it worked within this context. But anyways.
Yeah, and they've always got that idea too, where he's like Banner is imprisoned by the Hulk, and the Hulk is imprisoned by Banner, and there's these fractured psyches kind of at odds. And they've done multiple things over the years where let's try splitting them apart into separate bodies, or letting each entity have its day, or merging them back together. Like, they put them in soup and kind of split them apart, and.
Well, Doc all the Samson variations together. Too. Yeah. They've had too. Like, just you know, arguably, you know, at certain runs of the Hulk, let's say Peter David's run, where, you know, the id, the ego, and the superego were personified. You know, each writer seems to be, you know, each writer that does something important and impactful. I know that's not really a word with the Hulk. Is able to work those themes of duality or fractured personality into something quite compelling.
No, it absolutely. Yeah, Peter David was, I feel like he kind of reinvigorated the Hulk and tied a lot together and then expanded on all these kind of meanings and possibilities with the character. And even being a kid wanting to see, you know, your favorite green buddy running around destroying things, like, it didn't matter. Like, he would mess with things, but not in a way that would ruin the character, but would make him more interesting. Like, even when he became gray and weaker, like, that was almost more interesting in a sense for a while. And you know, it wasn't permanent.
When did you guys encounter the very first Hulk stories by Stanley and Jack Kirby?
That's a good question.
I encountered them pretty early in life because they were reprinted in paperback, like pocketbook.
That's right. I had the black and white paperback reprints as well.
As well,
I would have had them pretty young. Yeah.
As well as sort of a large, I think it was early graphic novel collections published by Fireside Books.
Hmm. Yeah.
But Those were in color, and it was quite shocking to me to have this early version that was a little more intelligent and a little more gruff. Mm-hmm. And they later retconned him into a separate personality, the Grey Hulk, Mr. Fix-It. But I remember being sort of a little shocked at how different and slightly gruffer and a little more articulate. He was almost like the Thing in those early days.
So he's not as strong. He's somewhere between, you know, the Green Hulk and Banner. Like, he has some intelligence, but he's just kind of a attitude.
Yeah, and in those early reprints, they color corrected him to green, but in the first printed comics of the 1960s, he was colored gray first.
Right.
Yeah, that's, and there was a reason for that too, right? That they switched to green, and that was just a printing issue. That was just because you're working on crappy newsprint, and you've got the four color press machines. And if you don't know what those are, they're massive machines where they make plates, and there's only the four colors: cyan, magenta, yellow, and black. You know, it's still, that technology is used today, but comics are printed digitally now. What would happen is the grays would just kind of blend in with the blacks and things like that. You'd have issues with the way it would print, so they picked the green color. And I think they're still, you know, thinking that's along Frankenstein's lines again too. So it switched, I think, right away, like after the first issue. I think it switched to green.
Well,
if not within the first. And Peter David kind of gave that explanation, right? It was because of the moon, and like it was like the weaker version before he was like fully gamma powered up to the Green Hulk. It was kind of an in-between Hulk, and a different personality kind of formed. And they go into these different personalities, explaining that by, you know, Hulk going through abuse from his father and things like that.
What's fascinating to me about the color coding of that is typically, you know, and again, there's exceptions to this rule, but typically superheroes, you know, Batman and Superman and Wonder Woman and Spider-Man and Captain America, they were in that sort of red, blue color range.
Yeah.
And it was actually sort of the villains in the green purple, like Lex Luthor and Green Goblin, et cetera, et cetera.
Joker.
So it's Joker, absolutely.
Right. Your primary colors are the good guys, and your secondary, tertiary colors are the bad guys, typically. Yeah.
But him being a monster and actually kind of an antagonist in a lot of early Marvel titles as well.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you know, that goes back to, like, even the fact that they wear tights, if you want to call them that, I don't really think of it that way, but it's because of the old circus performers, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And colorful and bright and, you know, athletic and all that sort of thing. So they became kind of like circus folk that would fight crime in a way. And red and blue are found to be the highest selling colors visually. So that's why you get a lot of that, like Spider-Man and Superman and things like Captain America. You know, there's kind of a visual response to those colors together.
That's so
different combinations. Yeah.
Even, I mean, look, the American flag, you see the red and the blue, and there's something striking about that you just associate it with a certain idea. It's absolutely true. It's so funny how
it's an incredible graphic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And comics are so very visually graphic that way, right? Like, it's got to be very clean and clear and like immediate response.
Yeah.
So Hulk being green and purple, like Sam's right, he'd be more of the Hobgoblin or Green Goblin colors, right? Not Hobgoblin, sorry.
Yeah, sort of the monster end of things. And it always really popped. Like, you know, this is why I think the Thing and Hulk fights are always so visually appealing. You know, that green and bright orange.
Yeah, they're directly color contrasting, yeah.
Yeah. It's true. When you think of all of Spider-Man's villains, he's got a couple that are, their main color is green, right? You got Green Goblin, you got Mysterio, you got the Vulture, you got the Lizard, and then
Scorpion.
Yeah. I think even at times, or maybe I'm just thinking of the animated series, but like the Dr. Octopus was sometimes,
he was
some variation. So
Vulture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to see,
Sandman.
Yeah, it's true.
So you could read into this, right? You could say like it's a good guy trapped in a bad guy's body or something, right? Like he appears to be a villain. And I think the public, the world around the Hulk treats him that way. Like, he looks like a villain. He's scary looking. He's not attractive. He's not beautiful in a classic sense, right? He's disfigured and large, right? It's imposing and scary, right? And if he's yelling or thumping around and he's, you know, he weighs half a ton and he's measured anywhere between 7 feet and 10 feet tall. And
yeah,
like it's, yeah. Yeah. You'd want to run away. I think that would be a typical, he's a primal, figure. And then we have a primal response to that figure.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So let's start off with our list. Casey, what would be your first, not your number one book per se, but what would be first on your list that you wanted to put in your top five?
Okay, if we're doing it, like, I'd have to keep it personal, I suppose.
Absolutely.
I don't want to be too objective with this and go, this is the best written or drawn, but
this is our favorites.
Your favorite. Yeah, that's
so
right.
Our
that's
personal right. favorites. So there's no wrong answer here.
No.
So I like to start off just with that the Hulk magazine, that issue 11, that first one I got, because it's amazing the cover's still on that thing. I flipped through so much. I didn't worry about, I took care of my stuff, but I mean, they're well read, you know. It's just an amazing Jusco cover for one thing. So just having these painted covers, and I think I tried drawing that Jusco Hulk. He kind of gave him a bit of a cartoony face, but it's wonderful. And they're like throwing this brick building at each other, him and that exoskeleton guy. Just wonderful. And then you got Ernie Chan's big, bright, colorful, amazingly inked art inside. It just like blew me away. And just the size of it when you're a little kid, you know, having this big magazine with your favorite character in it, like, just, it was just, something would hit you, connect just from seeing the character, like your mind would race. And this one, you know, it was just magical to me being a kid having that issue. It's hard to kind of pinpoint why, because I don't think I really understood as a child, but something really struck me about this character. Like, I just, I feel bad for him, but like, I admire him. Like, it'd be awesome to be as strong as that. It's just, there's something about all those muscles too that's kind of attractive. Like I want to draw them all. Just the fact that you can like jump around and kind of pick up anything or destroy anything.
Yeah.
Did this issue have a painted cover?
Yeah, so this is a Joe Jusco painted cover.
Oh, wow.
This is 1978. I didn't get it in 78. I was only 1 year old then. So I would have probably had this before, or just before 1980. Just a phenomenal book.
Now, as an artist, sorry, I just got a question for you guys.
Yeah.
As an artist, because the Hulk, there is no real definitive way to draw him. Like, is it exciting as children to see that there's, I can do whatever I want. I can make him as big as I want. I can make him as muscular. Like, is there a sense of freedom in learning how to draw where it doesn't have to look great, but you know it's the
right
Hulk because he's huge and he
right
can destroy anything if I want to.
Right. It's a good question, and it's something I actually turn over my mind a lot, because even though I saw the Hulk on TV at first, I never thought he looked right. It's like once you see the illustrated version, then you kind of get this, I think you get your own idea in your mind what he's supposed to look like. And then people get close to that ideal. Like, you get kind of some kind of amalgamation from different artists, and then you kind of pick and choose what you're, the elements that you like. So I love like what Joe Jusco did. Like, he did a perfect Hulk body, but I just said like the head's a little weird, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like the hair's great, but the mouth is off, you know, that kind of thing. So it'd be like, I like this from this artist, this from another artist. And that's why I say to people all the time, I wish John Buscema did more Hulk. I think he would have done a perfect Hulk.
And that was the Marvel house style back then too.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Before different artists started interpreting the Hulk differently, there was sort of, first Jack Kirby, but then I think Buscema, especially because of how to draw comics the Marvel way, all into, you know, as you went into the 80s, there was sort of a consistency to how the Hulk looked in terms of his proportions. And he was really, his width too, he was really quite almost as wide as he was tall, wasn't he?
Oh yeah, he's just a block. He's just a wall himself. And I didn't mind that. You know, I didn't mind seeing different interpretations. Like, it didn't matter. I was just so excited to see something new with the Hulk on it that I just would accept it. And, you know, just kind of absorb it, right? But over time, yeah, I think I developed kind of my taste, what my idea of the Hulk would be. Like, for other people, it's going to be maybe their first encounters, like what McFarlane did with the Grey Hulk. I mean, it was phenomenal, right? Like, that was a big influence on me. And Dale Keown was a massive influence, seeing his version. And they're very different, but they're both exceptional in their own way. And then they kind of add to what you already think of as the interpretation of, you know, his visual appearance.
Was there anything in the magazines that disturbed you? I just wanted to share my first experience briefly with the Hulk magazine, because again, I sort of got it late. I was basically going downtown Toronto to take classes at the Art Gallery of Ontario, and then some of the kids there would show me the comic stores and the used bookstores on Queen Street.
I almost wish we grew up together and hung out together. This would have been a good learning curve for me. I had, you know, I mean, I didn't have anybody else reading the Hulk with me. You know.
Well, the great thing is we can talk about it on car rides to Kingston
or on the podcast.
Yeah, there you go. But my first issue of the Rampaging Hulk, I got at this used bookstore, and again, it was sort of an old dusty copy, but I was starting to get into, like, you know, freaky stuff like heavy metal and Vampirella and Creepy and Eerie, and this was a magazine, right? And but it seemed fairly straightforward, a little, you know, the art and color and production value was a little better. And then I got to the point in this Rampaging Hulk comic where the Bruce Banner is staying at the YMCA, and a group of men are about to rape him in the showers. And it really, really quite disturbed me, because this wasn't something you would see in The Defenders, which is, you know, mostly the comic that I read at the time. And then later on, as I was going through old issues of fanzines, I did come across articles or letters or whatever basically pointing out the fact that, you know, homosexuals are hardly ever, never depicted in mainstream Marvel comics. Yet the one instance written by the editor-in-chief, Jim Shooter, they're depicted as rapists in the YMCA. And Shooter, oddly enough, tried to defend that scene because he said this actually happened to him when he was staying at a YMCA. But it is a little fascinating that sort of this adult content made it in, because the magazine didn't have the comics code. Was there any sort of instances like that for you?
I was just going to say that too. Like, these did not have the comics code authority. But I would say, like, I was a little bit young to pick up on things like that, or probably understand. Like, I found the stories in some ways hard to read. Like, I would read them, but not, I mean, I would follow what I could. But I wasn't taking in kind of the deeper stuff like that. I don't know if I would have I just thought maybe, you know, Bruce is being picked on, he's going to get beat up, you know. I don't know if I would have picked up on the meaning of that at that age. Mm-hmm. But you could definitely feel, yes, that there was something more adult going on. I felt like they were more adult, but I would just, like, couldn't wait to be more mature and be able to read these things. So I would kind of push, like, ahead of my time a little bit without understanding or having the experience or the knowledge. Like, I was naive for a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, and quite, I used to just, you know, I was very kind of on my own. I would play and read on my own, right? So I didn't really know what was going on there. Yeah, so, I mean, sometimes things were a little bit dry. They were a little bit heavy. They were trying to take the Hulk in kind of strange places that the regular comic series wouldn't go. But there were issues like that. I think there's some nudity in some of them. And, you know, the violence is a little different. Yeah, like, I don't know if I was disturbed in any way like that. I don't think that hit me.
It did take its cue, at least sort of the later issues, from the TV show a lot more. I know the early issues, there were more Marvel crossovers, right? Like Namor, wasn't Namor in one issue?
Oh, yeah, he's right near the very beginning. He's, I think, in the third one or something, yeah. And that's when they were black and white, still done in pencil, and I don't know if that was Bob Layton, I think, drawing those, maybe.
Wasn't there at least one Lou Ferrigno painted cover depicting Hulk as Lou Ferrigno?
Yes, so that was Joe Jusco again.
The master. I'm such a huge Jusco fan.
And you know, he was probably like 17 years old doing these covers. Like, he's still only in his 50s. I'm like, this is the late 70s, and he's painting these covers.
Well, apparently he was a New York cop back then.
Yeah, he's a big guy, and I think he was pretty fit as well.
Yeah, he modeled on, there's a famous, I think it's Marvel team-up, with someone dressed up, like, it was early cosplay. It was a photo cover where Captain America and Spider-Man are on the cover on the roof of, I guess, where Marvel Comics was. And, yeah, that was Joe Jusco in the Captain America outfit.
Yeah. He did some wonderful covers. They're all, like, so different, but very great. I don't know. Like, he would do different kind of styles a little bit each time. Yeah, I mean, the other painters on there, like Norum and
Earl Norum, yeah, the great Conan artist as well.
Yeah, he did some phenomenal painted covers for this as well. Yeah,
I wonder if any of this beautiful painted magazine art has showed up in any collections.
I have not seen any.
That would be fantastic to see these.
And it's funny too; they're not really super appreciated. Like, you can still kind of go around at conventions and stuff and find these for very reasonable prices. There's only 27 issues of the Hulk run of the magazine.
I think the magazine format is what sort of has people overlooking them, because I did enjoy the Howard the Duck magazines back in the day as well.
Yeah. I think it's just like, oh, they don't fit in my comic box, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's kind of mentality.
oddly,
as shelves, it's harder to shelf them.
Yeah, as we're discovering with Cauldron magazine as well, you do encounter some where do we rack these?
Yeah,
space haters. Yeah.
So Sam, how about for you? What's on your list to kick off yours?
Well, just to kick this off, I want to the Hulk that affected me the most on an emotional level, and I think really informed. Because up to that point, as we were saying, there was a certain formula to the Hulk, especially the childlike personality of the Hulk. And Mantlo, prior to this, had played around with it by, for example, giving the Hulk the brain of Bruce Banner for a time. So he went off to the Secret Wars and fought the Secret Wars on the side of the heroes with Bruce's intelligence. And then devolved into absolute savagery. I think Casey can help me out here. Was it Nightmare that caused that?
Yeah, Nightmare was a big part of that, yeah.
The Doctor Strange villain. So he reverted to a mindless, savage form and was shunted off to the crossroads.
I think it was almost like Banner was dead inside the Hulk's mind. So there was
pure
Hulk.
There was sign of Banner whatsoever. And Doctor Strange, being his friend from the Defenders, thought it would be more merciful to send him off to the crossroads. Yeah. And the crossroads was this other dimension that led to other dimensions. Like there was a tree, I think, or a signpost with fingers pointing in all different directions. Yep. And this mindless savage Hulk would basically go from planet, you know, dimension to dimension. And if it didn't suit him, it would return him to the crossroads where he'd have another choice. But at the very end of Mantlo's run, just before he was switching with John Byrne, like John Byrne and Mantlo would switch titles. Mantlo would go to Alpha Flight and John Byrne would take over the Hulk. But the Incredible Hulk 312 was, I believe, our introduction to the Hulk's Bruce Banner's parents, Brian Banner, his abusive father, and his kindly mother. I can't remember what her name is, but it was drawn by Mike Mignola. Beautifully drawn by Mike Mignola. I wasn't too fond of, is it Jerry Talik's inking over Mignola stuff because it overpowered his style. But for this story, the scratchiness really worked for the emotional rawness of seeing Bruce physically abused by his father on, yeah. you know, Christmas morning. His father basically saw that Bruce was far, as a toddler, was far more intelligent and, you know, I guess accused him of being some sort of mutant or something. He accused him of being a monster. And all through this, it was kind of a neat special effect. It wasn't a silhouette, but it was almost an outline of the Hulk over the child version of Bruce Banner. And it suggested that all this time, the Hulk was already inside, psychologically inside Bruce, waiting for the gamma bomb to unleash him on the world. And what's notable about this, because again, I was, as a kid, as a comics reader, Hulk had some interesting ideas, but it was never sort of a standout for me. It was never one of my favorites. Like and I mostly, and this was even a Secret Wars 2 crossover, I think, as well. I think it was the Beyonder showing the Hulk, Banner's childhood or something along those lines. But I was mostly following this because I knew John Byrne was going to be coming on board in an issue or two. I later learned, and this goes back to the accusations of plagiarism, I would later learn in, again, fanzines. I really, really loved, as a teenager, especially once I discovered these, like magazines like the Comics Journal, Comics Interview, Amazing Heroes, Comics Feature. The comic shops had all these magazines that took you behind the scenes and did interviews. But apparently, Bill Mantlo had found a story in progress by Barry Windsor Smith. And Barry Windsor Smith took his time with his comics, right? He had a few notable comics at the time, X-Men Life Death 1 and 2 featuring Storm, that were just classics. So supposedly this story was stolen from the one that Barry Windsor Smith was working on.
And, two strikes for Bill Mantlo.
Yeah, yeah. And the other thing is, you know, Windsor Smith went public with this, but has since, because he, I think it was, the issue was half complete as well when Bill Mantlo came across it and basically plagiarized it. So Barry Windsor Smith, over the past, what, 35 years, has been quietly adding to this story and revising it so that it's not the Hulk and Bruce Banner. It's but it does have to do with the Atomic Age and the discovery of the atomic bomb. And it's finally going to be released as a graphic novel called Monster. And it's been announced by over the past, you know, 35 years, it's been announced by various publishers over time. But yeah, I'm very, very anxious to finally see what Windsor Smith's vision of the story was. And I'm sure it's been, you know, improved on and added to and expanded. But hopefully the heart of the story is still there and you can still recognize the Hulk and Banner within the archetypes that he's using.
So that was Incredible Hulk 311, the one you read?
312.
312, okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you'll recognize it from a Secret Wars crossover.
Okay. Very cool. Mm. Okay, Casey, how about you? What's your second on your list?
Oh, this is tough. like most of my issues that I love are like the Peter David issues. Like, I want to give, like, a special shout-out to Jack Kirby's work on the first six. Like Sam said, like, we saw those pretty early on. And, I mean, it was just, like, he defined this character, right? There's just such weight and emotion in that stuff. It's hard picking favorites, but there's a few, and I don't know what to put in what order. I think it'd be hard not to put McFarlane's issue 340 when Grey Hulk fights Wolverine. I mean, that was just, I think even people who didn't read the Hulk were just grabbing that issue. And that iconic cover that's been homaged.
That's an incredible cover.
A thousand times.
Yeah.
Like, I think you know the one, right?
Oh, yeah.
The Hulk reflects.
It's incredible.
I've got a pretty sweet, pristine poster of that with the colors change, a red background and a green Hulk face, but it's pretty cool. But that was like a game changer for me when it changed the way I drew and the way, you know, I saw comics. That was exceptional. Sorry, it was just so fun, right? It was just gritty, and it was just everything you wanted to see happened in that book. Like, it was just a pure animal fight between Wolverine and the Hulk, and the claws going right through him, and, you know, his green blood coming out. And they're fighting in this snowstorm. And it was like, I think that was possibly the first issue where McFarlane started inking himself, because he had another inker before that. I can't think of the name. I don't know if it's Tony DeZeninga or somebody that was inking him. And it just, you could kind of see it was McFarlane's pencils, but it was just not pure McFarlane yet. And then he just, you know, and this is before, McFarlane really became the big deal he was. Like, he was definitely a superstar, like a young superstar. But this really, like, pushed it. I think before he got the, this is, I think, before he got the Spider-Man gig, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Before he started working on Spidey.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I think. Yeah.
I don't think he was working on those books concurrently, but, I think he made his name as he was doing the Hulk. But yeah, that issue is iconic for every reason that, you know, it should be. You got the cover, you've got the cameo feature of Wolverine. And I think, don't want to say for sure, but did that in some way cross over with the Fall of the Mutants event that brought Wolverine to that fight? Was there some sort of... was that the crossover reason? I don't remember for sure, but it tied in with X-Men stories as well. Like, it was something that counted for both of those characters. Like, it wasn't just a throwaway.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you what was going on. Yeah, I don't know if Sam might know, but yeah, there was like a bit of an X-Men kind of scattering, but I don't know what was going on with the X-Men then.
Yeah.
McFarlane only did, I think, like the 15 issues. And Eric Larson kind of co-drew and inked the last one. It was like this big issue with like a trial. It was like an oversized issue. And then there was a break on 335. Somebody else did that one. But 330, I think it was McFarlane's first. He did 330 to 334, and someone else was inking him. Then he came back. And I think it was about by issue 340, that Wolverine one where he was starting to ink himself, and you could see this real difference, though.
Mm-hmm.
And that, so, I mean, I got to put that up there.
Absolutely.
It's hard to say which one I would put in what order, but that one stands out for sure.
Absolutely. Yeah. Good pick. Sam, how about you? What's next for you on your list?
We've lost Sam.
Uh-oh. I think you're right. We have lost Sam.
Did we?
We did. I'm going to call him right back. Stay with us, people. Sam Noir will be back.
I'll just say, like, I know it's not like a deep story with the McFarlane one. It was just, you know, it was just a lot of fun. It's like with, like, the Hulk video game where you were just, like, running around smashing things and ripping cars and punching stuff. Like, it was just pure fun, right? It's not the deep, heavy storytelling stuff. Although, Peter David Wood had a lot of emotional elements. Sam's back.
I'm back. So,
he's disappearing again.
Are you there,
Sam?
Can
you hear me?
We can hear you. There you are. You're a little in and out.
Yeah. All good?
Yep.
Okay.
I can hear you guys.
All right.
I was yammering on about nothing, really.
We were just saying for that Incredible Hulk issue, the McFarlane and Wolverine one with that. What was the number for it, Casey?
340 was the Wolverine one.
340. I don't know if you were listening at the time or if you had cut out yet, but did that cross over with Fall of the Mutants? Because I feel as though those two stories, those two books merged in a very creative way that made the story make sense as opposed to just having a fight for a fight's sake.
Yeah, the X-Factor crossover, right?
Yes, yes, of Fall of the Mutants, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I knew there was, because I always wondered what would... That cover was always so striking, and it's collected in so many different ways with the Visionaries, and now you've got the omnibus of it. But it was also collected, I think I read it, in a Fall of the Mutants trade. So I'm like, that's so interesting that these Hulk issues tie into this story. I didn't know there was a crossover element to it, but it definitely was a creative way to get those two guys to have a knockdown, drag them out type of fight.
Oh, yeah. For sure. And McFarlane was being inked by someone else at the time, right?
Yeah, that's
not on this one. This one is the one, I think, where he started inking himself.
Oh.
Yeah. This one, I believe he did his own inks. But he did have another inker, for the first several, yeah. But it was like the last five or more he inked himself, yeah.
And that was a real iconic run for me. I have those sort of on my honorable mention with the Gamma Bomb. Yeah. I think Rick Jones had finally stopped being Teen Hulk.
Mm. He
reunited with Betty Banner, and then the leader showed up in his popcorn Jiffy Pop head incarnation.
Yeah, the mushroom head. Yeah. That's the first McFarlane issue, yeah, with Rick Jones. There's the cover, he's kind of in shadow, and he's like, Betty's flying in some S.H.I.E.L.D. car or something, and Rick Jones is like ripping it apart. He's on top of it. Yeah, there was like the Rick Jones Hulk. That's right. But I don't think we knew it was him right away.
Mm. Yeah, that was a really... That transition time was really odd because John Byrne was abruptly yanked off the title after he had separated Bruce and Hulk from each other.
Yeah.
As well, I think there were some interim issues with Al Milgram before Peter David had a fill-in issue and eventually took over.
That's right.
The longest running Hulk writer of all time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So John Byrne was there doing issues 314 and 319. Peter David didn't come on until issue 328, and then he came back and did his big run from issue 331 onward. Yeah, so there was like a couple little gaps. I think you're right. I think it was Al Milgram before Peter David. And I think it was weird. Like, they were doing weird things and trying to tie things up. I know, like, Mary Severn was inking a while too, and she did an excellent job on some of those issues. But I don't really remember a heck of a lot what happened there. There's a lot of stuff going on. It was like twisting my brain as a child too. Like when you're just used to that same formula, you know, the Hulk jumps somewhere and then he gets antagonized, you know, or Banner gets antagonized, turns into the Hulk, settles it and jumps away till the next issue. Mm-hmm. Like Peter David really brought like a whole other level of depth to the stories and really went places with the Hulk and introduced all these characters and, you know, different iterations of characters.
And I think because it was in sort of that transition period, it was what allowed McFarlane and Peter David as well to really push that envelope of what could be done with the previous Hulk formula. Of course, John Byrne being allowed to do something very different. And Byrne's run, they even started hinting at the Gray Hulk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was going to do so. I think Byrne even put him in the goop and all that, and he had him doing psych talks with Doc Samson and stuff. Mm-hmm. He did such a short run. I guess he had this big plan for the Hulk, apparently.
I don't think we ever heard
what it was. And Jim Shooter's like, yeah, go for it. And then once he starts working on the book, they're like, no, you don't like it. You're out.
Well, the plan was, and again, I got this from, and I believe it was, well, there was a lot of fanzine coverage at the time, but I think specifically it was, I want to say, the Amazing Heroes preview special, where John Byrne laid out his plan that Hulk and Banner would be separated, and then Banner would lead the Hulkbusters, and this would be the new status quo, where this mindless version of the Hulk, very similar to the one that roamed the crossroads, would be rampaging across America. And ironically, it would be Banner and the team he put together that would be in the General Ross, Thunderbolt Ross role of chasing down his alter ego.
Yeah. Hmm.
That would have been interesting.
I got to say, I love John Byrne's art on the Hulk. Yeah. Now, I know he's as good as his inker in a sense. I don't know if that was Terry Austin inking him back then on the Hulk, but
and the wonderful wrong. There was a wonderful Lost issue as well. Byrne intended for an issue to be entirely in splash pages.
Yeah, but, I was going to bring that up. It's a really nice book. Yeah,
but wasn't allowed to do it in the main title, and I think they picked it up for Marvel Fanfare, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know if they put it in an if it was just there, or if they put it in an annual as well. But yeah, I think it was just Marvel Fanfare. And I think he's with like an indigenous guy in the desert, and it's just all like splash pages. Was there type as well? I'm trying to even remember if there was words or not. If that was one of the first like that.
Oh yeah, it could have been a silent issue too. I'll have to dig that issue out. It's not with the rest of my Hulks; it's with my Marvel Fanfare. So
yeah,
I always sort of almost forget about it because it's filed elsewhere.
Yeah, I've got it somewhere here. Like, I don't think he was the first to do that. I think that might have been Walter Simonson or somebody who did that first.
Oh, the Manhunter. Yeah, I think they had a him and Archie Goodwin.
Yeah, but John Byrne's run was exceptional. Like, even the stuff where Banner's inside working on the computers and I guess it's S.H.I.E.L.D. or whatever, you know, and there was that hologram of the Hulk, like that splash picture where he was going to attack the Hulk and Betty's coming in like, Bruce, look out, you know. Just beautiful art, though, like just amazing, exceptional. Like, he did a great job. It would have been nice to see him go a little farther and see what he could do.
Yeah. I had read somewhere that he was waiting for the Peter David run to end, like, very badly, because he did not like where Peter David went with it. He was like very critical of his particular Hulk run. But I mean, that's Byrne for
Byrne
you.
Byrne did come back.
Yeah,
he with did. Ron Garney.
With Ron Garney, yeah. But I don't know if people remember that anywhere near as well as maybe his first run that he did with the Hulk.
No.
Yeah. So Sam, what's your second book on your list?
Next book on my list, we're going back to the earliest days of the Hulk. Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale do their
book.
Series of color, I guess, emotional and tonal colors focusing on one of the iconic Marvel characters, in this case, Hulk Gray, which I think really focused on the Bruce-Betty relationship, especially in those early days, in a way that no one else did. So that's mostly the reason why I really, really, that resonates with me.
Yeah.
You're going to be surprised, but I've never read that. I've always heard how good it is. I heard it's one of the best Hulk stories ever, and I've yet to read it or own it. Yeah. I kind of got out of I stopped. This is going to be sacrilegious on this podcast, but I did drop buying the Hulk after a certain time, like in the later 400s or something. I just couldn't take what was going on. And then I kind of went back.
Was this after Peter David's run?
Oh, yeah, long after.
These
really
stand out.
Sam, you still there with us? I think he cut out again. I think he's still connected, but he might have just cut out.
Can you guys hear me?
We can hear you.
Yeah,
there you are.
Okay.
Now.
Yeah, so I do recommend that you check that out, Casey. It's, again, going back to the earliest days and sort of the early status quo, but fleshing it out in terms of relationship. I think Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale really did a fantastic job on all their color titles in painting a deeper emotional palette
with Daredevil Yellow and Spider-Man mm-hmm. Blue. What was the other one? Captain America White.
Mm-hmm. That was more done recently, but yeah, there's something really special about those series that they did. And I mean, I love them all, but dare I say the Hulk one, there's something really special about that one.
Mm. I'll have to check it out, even, you know, despite the recent news on Jeff Loeb, I'll still maybe go read that one. Mm-hmm. I know I've, you know, it's one of those ones I've meant to, and I've enjoyed all their, you know, Batman Long Halloween books, and, you know, I like kind of their unique take on things, their storytelling.
Well, it really resonates because it, again, that Bruce Betty relationship in the early days, it again was very kind of almost superficial.
Yeah.
And then given all the ups and downs and will they, won't they, and split apart and come back together over hundreds of issues, I think that really set a base tone for where they started off at. And where they have gone since there, all the way to modern days with her current immortal Hulk incarnation.
Right. Yeah.
And the difficulty they have connecting.
Right. And there were scenes out of that Grey Hulk book that I felt were taken directly from, or the movie Incredible Hulk, I feel, took some scenes or some moments that are very powerful from the book. The one
I
where
agree.
when him and Betty are reconnected for the first time in the rain and they have to hide out underneath the cave, I feel like that mm-hmm. was a panel straight out of that Grey Hulk book. And there really? Isn't as much dialogue in it, but there's so much said. I'm not sure if I'm explaining it well enough, but I think Sam would know what I mean, because he's absolutely right. There's something really special about that artwork in that book, especially because the colors are muted, whereas with the Spider-Man Blue and with the Daredevil Yellow, those colors are very much, they're vibrant and they're very key to the story. But this one being gray, you would think like it's morose and kind of morbid, and it's sad, but there's something lovely about it. I don't know how to explain it better than that.
Mm. Well, that's the power of comics too, right?
Yeah. Like
you can say so much visually.
Yeah.
It says a lot for the medium. So I guess it's almost black and white then in a way. It's just gray. Like, is there purple in there too? I remember there's purple on the cover or something, wasn't there? Like, didn't they still make his pants purple?
Oh yeah, there's still color. There's still color,
there's
but
still
you
color,
they
yeah.
really
but
they,
it's all muted and
yeah. Yeah.
Huh. Yeah,
so that's
it
like
really does
emotional tone.
Play. Yeah, it really does play with the idea of gray as a color on an emotional spectrum.
Right.
Yeah, I've had some good talks with Jonathan Kolchuba about our story too, like using color symbolically and how few people do that. The comics that you can do that really well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good pick, Sam. Good pick. Casey, you're up.
Yeah.
Number three.
Oh, man. Like, as I said at the beginning, I have trouble doing this, but I mean, like, I'm tempted to almost say, like, I like this run, I like this run, I like
yeah,
this artist.
Yeah, you could do that too.
You know, absolutely. Like, it's hard to pick, but there are some that stand out, and I don't want to be, like, quoted as this is forever my all-time favorites or not, but there's some that have come to mind, and just like the McFarlane one, I have to put Keown in there as well, and he came in, there was, like, the last issue of the Countdown issues where Walter Simonson was doing the covers, and they introduced this character called the Madman. And Keown got in this book at issue 369, and you see this guy's art, and it's like nothing you've ever seen before. You know, even after, you know, McFarlane's crazy run and all that, like this stuff just was so different. It was so, like, round and shaded well and solid. It was almost like Neil Adams on another level. Clean and solid, but a real meaty style to this art. And the first image is like the Hulk. He's kind of a gray Hulk still, and he's a sort of emaciated sitting in this chair. And you know, Dale just like put everything he had into this book. Like,
and what a shock! It was Jeff Purvis, right? That did the first three issues of that four-part series.
Yeah, he was kind of rounding out his run with Joe Fixit.
I was never, like, I didn't appreciate him at the time as much. I think I had a harder time accepting that. So I appreciate it a lot more now. And he did a lot of great stuff. And there's so many memorable moments and great writing going on. And it was a lot of fun. It was just such a different take for the Hulk, like to be, you know, this kind of like gambler and, you know.
Vegas enforcer.
Yeah, yeah.
But the grittiness of Purvis, again, he's very underrated, I think. And again, he's not appreciated as much because he is sandwiched between two superstars, especially eventual Image comic superstars like McFarlane and Keel.
Yeah, it's almost unfair, right, to go up in the middle of that Oreo.
But everyone has very fond memories of Mr. Fix-It. And that was all Purvis for the most part, wasn't it?
Wasn't that fun too? Just how, because back in the day, they used to be like, okay, if Kirby worked on the book and you were next, you would kind of slowly transition out of that style into your style, and you'd be on the book for quite a while. But these guys, it was just like, here's your style, okay, next guy, and they were so different. It's like, okay, now we're hitting you with Perv style. Now we're hitting you with Purvis. I'm not sure how you say his name. And then there's Keown, right? And they were so different, like the art styles, but.
And that was the run that with Peter David that really allowed for that. And again, the Image creators had essentially come in and broken the house style. There are a few other guys like Art Adams and et cetera, that had sort of broke the house style. But for the most part, it was this generation of creators that said, no, I can draw in my style and do my interpretation of the Hulk and it being okay. I think Peter David had said at different points that he envisioned part of Bruce Banner's superpowers are actually shape-shifting, to that his exterior sort of reflects his interior state of mind or whichever personality is dominant.
Exactly.
So that seemed perfectly apropos. That each artist that comes in gets to re- and Peter David did that for the most part as well. Incoming with each incoming artist, he would kind of try to reinvent the title a little bit to suit them.
And you got to say, like, me and you are both big fans of the Hulk series now, Immortal Hulk. So if anyone has not picked that up, I mean, get your hands on, because he's like they're doing that. Ewing and Joe Bennett, like they're doing that to the extreme, right? Like. Creating that horror book and the, you know, just shape-shifting the Hulk in crazy ways.
If not for the fact that the run hasn't quite been complete yet, this, and I, again, we don't know if he sticks the landing or not, basically. I think he's got, 15 more issues to go till issue 50 is when the run ends. But it will be interesting to see at the end of that run, and I'm pretty sure it will enter my top five.
Yeah, they're just doing it, like they're redefining it now, and it just looks so fun, right? And making it a horror book.
Yeah, people are comparing it to Alan Moore's Swamp Thing in that he's completely taken everything that's gone before, flipped it up on its side, reinvented the character, but negated none of the history. He's using that rich tapestry of Hulk history. So the fact that long-term readers like you and I have geek moments all the time when he's doing callbacks, but new readers, he's reintroduced elements so slowly and in such an organic way that new readers can follow along as well.
But will we see Barit?
Given some of the characters we've seen.
Yeah, I look forward to reading that in an omnibus format. I'm trade waiting on that book right now because I find when I read it in chunks, I enjoy it the most instead of like a month to month. I would lose track of where I've been at. But I want to read that from beginning to end again because those first 18, 20 issues are so solid. And then the book does some... It goes somewhere else where I feel now I'm a little bit lost, where I'm forgetting how we got here. So to read this in a nice long format is going to really pay off because I you can tell that he's telling this story in a way that for the long term we're going to look back on it and marvel at just how remarkable it was.
It might be harder for you if not following along all those years ago because I think they're really trying to echo. They're peppering it with all these things from the past,
like bringing in all these characters, like Sam's saying. So it's a lot of fun to see what they're kind of doing with that. I wanted to kind of bring up too, there's a friend of mine who worked at the comic store before me, Darren Hick, who lives in South Carolina, which is a scary place to be right now. Brilliant guy though, philosopher professor. And he wrote this essay a while back, a long time ago. I don't know if you'd want me saying this publicly, but it was about Spider-Man. So Sam, you would enjoy this, and it was published. And it was the whole idea of that because of the monster books being canceled, like the whole sort of McCarthy era of comics with, Seduction of the Innocent book coming out and then, you know, going to trial and the EC guys and putting the Comics Code Authority on books. Marvel's answer to that was to make, like they could bring monster stories and horror stories, but make them kind of like kid friendly.
Kaiju, Godzilla and King Kong were big at the time. So thus you had the original version of Groot or Fing Fan Foom.
Yeah. So like Spider-Man, if you think of him, right, like Darren was saying, was, you know, he's half man, half spider. Like this is kind of a horrific idea. Like he's a monster, right? And the Hulk's a monster as well. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter how they got there. Like it was gamma rays or cosmic rays or radioactivity, whatever scary thing was happening.
Yeah. The Thing was a monster, mm-hmm. and they had a giant monster on that first Fantastic Four cover.
Mm-hmm. I think even if you saw Mr. Fantastic in real life, you'd be horrified in a way.
Totally.
But they make it like graphic and friendly and imaginative. It's not as scary in your mind, but it's exciting enough, you know, and it's okay for kids. But I think what I'm trying to say is like they're bringing all that back now, where it's like now you can kind of unleash the true horror element that it's meant to have, like the true depth of what it is to be this monster and you know, what they're capable of, what the effect would be if you were encountering the Hulk. Like Joe Bennett and Ewing are doing that like in a beautiful way. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm trying my best not to spoil things for audience and for Eric. There's so much we could talk about. Maybe when that run ends, we can all sit down in a book club type analysis.
Yeah, yes. We could reconnoiter and do another Hulkophile podcast. Yeah.
Well, just playing off of Casey's pick, I also have Dale Keown. And Peter David's run there on my list. Specifically, though, the build-up to the merged Hulk storyline.
Is this the Honey, I'm Home issue?
Yeah.
I was tempted to put that in there.
It was so amazing and clever and reinvented the Hulk in a way that would basically, inform everybody else that followed. Pretty much. Anyone.
Again, what a cover. You know,
yes.
Iconic cover.
Yes, for sure. And I first actually, because I was a kid growing up in Toronto and would, as an 11, 12-year-old, go to early Comic-Cons at like the Ontario College of Arts would have them in the basement or at the basement of the Sheraton. They're very much like these little one-day shows with a lot of local artists. And I had started reading this indie series. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles essentially led me to black and white indies. And there was a company called Aircell, which has a fascinating history because they started out, they're a Canadian company out of Ottawa that started off as a heating and air duct company. And there was a comic I loved called, as a kid, it doesn't hold up very well today, called Samurai, created by Barry Blair. But what really sort of flipped my mind, at a certain point, Dale Keown, I think this was his first official published work, became the artist and really brought a certain dynamism. It wasn't 100% professional art yet, but it was a lot more dynamic than what had sort of come before. And it was cleaner as well. And it was a soft reboot of the title where the main character's clone took over. But yeah, from then on, I sort of became a Dale Keown fan, and especially having met him as a young kid and got him to sign my books at these conventions. So I got to watch him evolve from this early issue of Samurai through to, I think the title was called Dragon Ring, and then eventually it evolved, which was more of a Terry and the Pirates kind of comic.
Yeah.
That eventually evolved into a superhero title, which I suspect is what Dale Keown really wanted to draw, called Dragon Force. Hmm. And so it was a real thrill to see him on The Incredible Hulk.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I always hear people holding him in the highest regard when it comes to artists who've worked on the Hulk. People, that's like their sweet spot. They always bring up Dale Keown's art as being that, mm-hmm. that high watermark. I mean, of course, you have McFarlane and Gary Frank later on, but they always, in reference to the Peter David run, you hear Dale Keown's name very frequently.
Yeah. Gary Frank and Mark Farmer did a good follow-up. They weren't quite as strong as Dale's work, but, you know, they were consistent and quite clean and yeah. had a good style as well.
Mm-hmm. I'm a fan of Gary Frank's Hulk, but and it suited the story at the time because it was the merged banner. But part of me couldn't quite get behind the quote. I'm doing finger quotes. The handsome Hulk that Gary Frank did. You know what I mean?
I still have trouble with that. I even have trouble with the way George Perez did it.
I was going to mention Future that. Imperfect. Well. Yeah.
Like, I love his Maestro, but that's the only thing I just have a hard time with at the head.
Absolutely. And when Keown did the merged Hulk, there was still elements of the monster in there. And actually, we were speaking of the Immortal Hulk, all the body horror that goes on in the Immortal Hulk. In some ways, part of it, it was played with both Byrne and McFarlane, but it really, really became a thing in Dale Keown's run when I guess it was the Green Hulk and Banner and the Gray Hulk all fighting for control at the climax of this merged Hulk storyline, where essentially Peter David had, as I mentioned before, had delineated them as representations of Banner's id, ego, and super ego. And in order for them to get better, he had, who's the ringmaster? Who's the hypnotist?
Yes.
Do hypnotherapy as a last resort to merge these three personalities together. Now, this has since been retconned, but those two or three issues that were leading up to it were just phenomenal and spectacular, and everything just came together perfectly between Keown's art and being the perfect artist for this, and David's innovative approach to the character. Again, it was almost Alan Moore Swamp Thing style reinvention of the character.
And it was nice seeing Peter David and Keown come back and do that the end story as well.
Yes, that was
too long
fantastic.
Ago. Yeah, it was just this apocalypse. Like Banner's like the last thing alive on the planet, almost.
Was it sentient cockroaches that were?
Yeah. He had this weird little computer following him around.
Beautifully drawn.
And he's like 200 years old. He doesn't know. He doesn't really talk. You know, he just wants to die. It's like that stupid Banner.
Yeah, it really created as sort of the twin alternate futures that David came up with. The really bleak one of Hulk the End and Future Imperfect. Yeah, and sometimes it's hard to go back. Recently, Keown and David got back together for yet another Hulk story. And again, especially now that we're enjoying the Immortal Hulk so much, it was nice to see them back together, but it just wasn't the same. Mm-hmm. You know, they had reached certain heights, especially with that the end. Yeah. So it was it was nice seeing them, but it wasn't necessary.
Right.
Yeah.
For that recent, I can't even remember what it was called, but I do remember being a little disappointed at you'd think they'd have a story that was a little more special, like the Hulk the End.
Right. Yeah, sometimes you can't go back home, as they say.
Did you read that issue, Casey?
Not the one you're talking about, like the Hulk the End, yes, but not that one. I'm not sure of the one you're mentioning.
Worth flipping through, but again, you know, this is, I think the end was Keon's return to the character after the pit, right?
Yeah.
So he brought all that power that he had brought to bear with the full freedom to draw how he liked in a relatively creepy, I mean, even the Hulk was sort of his skin, because of the radiation, like things were affecting his skin. So he really did look monstrous.
Yeah, like he was definitely all wrinkled up and everything. Yeah. And his green, like it was like a darker green. Mm-hmm. It's always a weird thing, like what the right green color is, too. They always say emerald, but he's never really been emerald green.
No, and I guess it depends on the artist's style as well. I know that it sort of shifts.
Yeah.
And again, depending on what sort of coloring is in vogue at the time, too. I remember the switchover to when Marvel needed to start competing with Image, they switched over from the newsprint to the glossy and the digital colors. And they had a few years of trying to perfect that and play around with that, especially as different artists like Liam Sharp and the Kubert brothers came in.
Yeah. I like him as a nice olive green or a darker green. Mm-hmm. You know, sometimes I like him in a blue pant.
What's next on your list, Casey?
I'm just going to kind of lump them together. Like we've already talked about John Byrne's run. But there's a couple, like there's a few books that stand out for me. I might just maybe rhyme off kind of quick.
Yeah, sure.
There was the Sam Keith issue he did, 368, where he fights, I think it is Jekyll
Mr.
and Hyde.
Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
Mr. Hyde. Mr. Hyde, Marvel, yeah. The Marvel version of Mr. Hyde. Masterful issue.
Yeah, that's an excellent kind of one that just kind of poked in there out of nowhere, and it was a lot of fun. Great Hulk again. There's the Hulk and Thing that Starlin writes in.
The big change.
Yeah, which is it's just pure fun again, but so beautifully done. I mean, Wrightson just knocked it out of the park with the art. And like, I think the art's better than the Spider-Man one he did, the Hooky book he did.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think he did a phenomenal job on this.
And the larger Marvel graphic novel format of the time really, really let it sing as well. And what a great ending.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a hilarious ending. It was almost played for comedy, too.
It like, is, yeah. It's funny. It's funny.
The Hulk and the Thing as these sort of mismatched buddies, almost like a, 1930s slapstick misunderstanding in space.
Yeah.
Which is surprising for Starlin and Wrightson, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm picking these because I'm an art guy, right? Yes. Like, I'm not picking them for the depth of the storytelling, necessarily.
And great minds think alike. These are all in my honorable mentions. Wow.
And I also love the crossover with Batman and the Hulk with Jose Luis Garcia Lopez. I thought he did a fantastic Hulk. Like, I love the art in that issue. And, you know, Batman, like, everyone's drawn well in that book. It's like joke, classic Batman. Like, but his art was just excellent. I would love to own a page of that. Or he fights that yellow kind of blob monster guy too, and like Hulk's kind of imprisoned inside of him. He has to like blow him apart, like rip him apart. He's got these kind of like yellow little bars on his chest, and Hulk's inside there.
As a kid, you could really appreciate that, especially, was it published in that large tabloid format?
It was.
Oh, because yes. I had it in the little paperback format, unfortunately, and I bet it looked so much better as a tabloid.
Well, that's how I had it first as well. I actually had, like, the little novel. Like, that was how I knew it as a kid. And later on, I saw it as, like, sort of the Treasury edition. And I'm not sure which company. I think it was just, like, both companies made that crossover event, kind of like the Spider-Man, Superman thing, I think was the precedent for that.
I think the tabloids came out first, and then for the mass market, because I remember at the same time I had also bought not Superman versus Spider-Man, but Superman and Spider-Man, the second crossover in paperback format.
Right.
at the same time, I bought the Incredible Hulk and Batman.
And I have a collection of other Hulk Treasury editions, but they're basically, and there's like sometimes like a Spider-Man story in there as well, and they're usually reprints though, just oversized. So you get like old Herbie trim, you know, stories and things in there.
I could easily do an entire, because I also collect tabloids, those Treasury editions or Marvel or DC, or whatever the DC version is called. And they're hard pack to store, but I love them. Just as a kid, like holding one, they were almost as big as you were.
Yeah.
When I was a kid too, I had this giant coloring book, the whole coloring book. It was huge. It was like three times the size of those Treasury editions.
Oh wow!
I still have it somewhere. I have a few of those Mego toys as well.
Oh yeah, both like, sizes, the 8-inch and the 12-inch.
I've got a few of each.
They even had the three. They had two different versions of the 3 3/4-inch. One was the comic action heroes with the, I call it the squatting position, and then the pocket heroes where he had straight legs. But it was always fun to put him in the Batmobile. I don't know why. It just seemed very comical for me for the Hulk to like, Hulk drive Batmobile, and he just Spider-Man would be terrified because the Hulk couldn't drive.
Mine would be fighting Mr. T because it was like I had like the small Mr. T and then a 12-inch Mr. T with the big figure, you know. They would fight. Mr. Which T would lose his ear feather.
Which one was your favorite of those figures?
Oh, I mean, I enjoyed that. There was like the 12-inch doll. I've got a few of those as well. I think I still have one in the box. Yeah.
The 12-inch was the best Christmas ever. That 12-inch doll.
You only had like the cloth pants and shirt, right? The torn pants and shirt. Just coming that white box. It was just awesome.
Mego actually had a prototype Lou Ferrigno head for that figure, which they never used. I'm not sure why they never did, but I'll have to send you a picture of it. It's pretty good, and I would have loved to have had a Ferrigno version of that figure.
I'll have to show you my crazy Hulk toy collection. I've got like four giant Rubbermaids filled with stuff.
Oh man, that could be an entire episode of Sam's toy collection and AC's toy collection.
Like I have Lou Ferrigno stuff too. Yeah.
There are so many weird Hulk oddities. I won't go into it now, but we could easily just
like a Hulk helicopter.
I have Hulk helicopter, and it's like, why does Hulk need a helicopter?
I have Hulk soap.
Oh wow, the toy one that's would definitely like have to be a video. We'd have to see that on YouTube to just see all these relics be pulled out and these oddities.
Well, I guess because of that TV show coming out in 77 to 81, it was just this huge boom. Like Hulk was just this big thing.
Everyone
basically anything they could slap a Hulk logo or a sticker on. Like there was I had the Hulk utility belt, which is awesome. I think a few years ago, I bought a mint and package version. I'll have to show you guys that.
I don't think I have that. I've got the wallets and stuff.
It was Canadian. It was either brown or black wallets, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I had a Spider-Man of that, and I have acquired the Hulk one.
Yeah.
The Hulk parachuting figure.
Yeah, and there's one where he's like in the back of this pickup truck breaking out of a cage.
Oh yeah, and the different rage cages too. Those are always fun toys. There's a whole different series of them over the years with the Hulk just breaking through. But
the '80s were a lot of fun. And the Hulk always looked so different. Every toy was so different.
Oh yeah.
There's no consistency to the colors or the look of them really.
But we digress. Is it your turn or my turn?
I think it's your turn, Sam. Casey,
I shot off pretty quickly, and then I think I'm sort of done.
Okay, well, I've got Banner by Brian Azzarello and Richard Corbin. This was during their experimental phase. I think it was a Marvel Knights title in their Startling Stories line of sort of what-ifs. And I feel like it was the first time that someone really, truly tried to write to the horror of the duality, like true horror and the antagonism between these two, especially with an artist like Richard Corbin and a misanthropic writer like Azzarello. And yeah, it was just sort of fun seeing Corbin as well, you know, have the Hulk, seeing his version of the Hulk fighting the military.
Wild.
Yeah, yeah, it's worth it just to flip through. And again, it's often overlooked because it's sort of out of continuity, and Richard Corbin is such a acquired taste for a lot of people.
Yeah, but I mean, like, you know what you're getting with him. He's been so consistent and good.
Yeah,
decades.
And a lot of people consider it very sort of out of character. I won't spoil it, but yeah, it is. But since then, a lot of other Hulk writers have sort of picked up on a lot of the darkness and the antagonism that Azzarello introduced, notably Bruce Jones, and even I think Al Ewing taps into that on his run.
Yeah, yeah, I was going to ask about Bruce Jones, because a lot of people say that Al Ewing picks up on some of the things that Bruce Jones was trying to do as far as making the Hulk more of a horror story or a monstrous kind of character. He's always been, but he really tapped into that sort of storytelling of it. And Al Ewing yeah. kind of is not cribbing it, that wouldn't be the right word, but building off of that sort of aesthetic that he did. But you're saying that was Azzarello and Richard Corbin before or after that that Bruce Jones run?
I believe it was before, but I'm sure smarter listeners than me can correct me. But I believe it was. Bruce Jones' run is kind of fascinating because for the folks out there who don't know, Bruce Jones came up through the horror anthologies, like Creepy, Eerie, mm-hmm. And then he sort of started his own in the 80s creator-owned phase. He sort of started his own horror comics, color horror comics, with basically a murderer's row of artistic talent in the pages of Alien Worlds and Twisted Tales. And yeah, he was a very unlikely Hulk writer, but I think at the time, I think, who was it? Stuart Moore was coming in from Vertigo and might have worked with Jones on some of the Vertigo anthologies at the time and brought Jones in. And he brought a real flavor that, again, wasn't everyone's taste. I personally enjoyed it until it kind of ran out of steam. And I feel like he did sort of succumb to some of the pressure to turn it more into superhero type stuff, or at least supervillain fights. Mm-hmm. But his run, I was really informed by the Hulk TV show in that the Hulk would only show up. It was mostly about Banner in his interactions. And when the Hulk showed up, it made an impact. And often that impact was sort of either the aftermath that he would wake up to or even off screen. The power of suggestion. Bruce Jones was really, really playing off this. And there's a pretty famous story. I'm not sure where I had read this, but it was all about a 10-year-old, I guess, who was a huge fan of the Hulk and went up to Bruce Jones at a convention and basically said to him, hey, you're the guy writing the Hulk right now? And Bruce Jones is, yes, I am. And the kid just sort of yells at him, where's the Hulk? You know, as he's paging through the issue. And I can totally see that. This was Marvel in bankruptcy, just throwing things at the wall, seeing what sticks, and really trying to roll into that adult audience. But unfortunately, probably at the cost of, a very small kids audience.
Yeah, I had just recently listened to Axel Alonso actually talk about when...
Maybe it was Axel Alonso, because both Axel and Stewart had come over from Vertigo. So it was probably Axel Alonso.
Yeah, he said that was one of the books that he reached out to Bruce Jones and said, you know, do the Hulk in more of an adult style. Like, don't be scared to take a chance and make it a horror book. And he was the one that actually, when I heard that, I'm like, oh, okay, that's where he goes. And now Al Ewing is kind of doing something similar, that with the Marvel Knights line and them trying to reinvigorate, because like you just said, you know, Marvel was on the verge of bankruptcy, and they were trying to now reinvigorate, bring it back to life, but by doing things with these characters that no one had done before, taking the chance to do it. Kind of what he was doing at Vertigo, he said, let's allow our creators to have that same sort of space to work in, to see what they come up with. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. What else you got, Sam?
And Bruce Jones' run is definitely worth checking out. The big difference between this and the Immortal Hulk is that Bruce Jones really... it's all about shadows. He's creating a noir title. And I'm completely forgetting who the artists were, but he did have a really great run of artists on that title as well. My final entry in my top five is, of course, Future Imperfect. Casey and I both have said, we're not 100% in love with the way George Perez, and again, this was probably in the script or editorial mandated, his sort of handsome version of the Hulk, which was probably based on Gary Frank's version. Yeah. Actually, it was based on Gary Frank's version.
It was kind of the Three Stooges Mo haircut.
And the super skinny face on that really traditional wide body just didn't quite look right.
And yet Maestro looks so good.
Yeah, that's the whole thing. The highlight of this, of course, is Maestro, his design for the Maestro. Now, again, this happened this week. I in the comic stores, there's a Maestro comic that dropped this past week. And I got super excited because I thought I hadn't heard of this. And it's Peter David and George Perez. Turns out it's a reprint.
Oh.
Yeah.
But it is a pretty, stunning package. And if folks haven't read Future Imperfect, I totally, it's in some ways it's an alternate future, but it involved the present day Hulk going into that future. And Peter David had done a lot of wonderful psychological stuff in terms of the Maestro, the future Hulk, being this tyrant. And trying to convince his younger incarnation to just lean into this, accept it, because otherwise only heartbreak. Like, heartbreak is what led you to this point of having to, you know, become the conqueror of this future post-apocalyptic world. It's very Mad Max, you know, in a George Perez, you know, cast of hundreds, cram hundreds of people into every drawing. The art, other than, you know, our nitpicks with the Hulk itself, is George Perez at the height of his powers.
Yeah, don't let us say the skinny face or anything, like, should turn you off. Like, it's exceptional. Other than that, like, the art is second to none. It's total Perez. The story is great. I love the trophy room.
Yes.
You know.
Perez.
There's a lot of Easter eggs kind of all the way through it that way.
Yeah, I've heard Peter David actually say that was his favorite thing he worked on while he was on the Hulk, because of specifically, he goes, when that trophy room shows up, he goes, the things that he put in there, all those Easter eggs, he goes, it just blew my mind. He goes, I know George Perez is known for putting everything on the page, but he goes, that one even shocked me. And going back to the Bruce Jones series, Sam, it was John Romita Jr. who was the artist.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Oh. Mm.
And I want to say Eduardo Risso did an arc as well with the Absorbing Man.
My Marvel app. I'm taking a look at seeing who I know.
Oh, okay.
Eminem was there. Liam Sharp was
Eminem.
There.
Yes, Eminem.
Yeah.
Mm.
Bucciolato was also a part of the run.
Yeah,
it's even Deodato for a while was doing some Hulk stuff.
During Peter David's run, some great artists. Again, I don't think they ever reached
that. Was it Adam Kubert was on there for
Adam
a bit?
Adam Kubert, Liam Sharp, Medina was okay. But they never quite, on Peter David's run, they never quite reached the heights of Dale Keown again and Todd McFarlane again, in my opinion. But and I was really looking forward to Liam Sharp's run, just because I was a big fan of his Marvel UK work on Bloodseed and and yeah. Death's Head, but apparently a monthly deadline just wasn't for Liam Sharp at that point, and the background sort of really suffered. Although that Man Thing, the two-part Man Thing issue was amazing. Liam Sharp would later go on to do a Man Thing series with DeMatteis.
There's so many things I could say. Like, I was trying to stay away from kind of the modern stuff there. Like, I'm sure people are going, like, where's World War Hulk? And, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, Planet Hulk specifically, too.
Planet Hulk, yeah. And I'm, like, kind of staying away. Like, for me, it's stuff that influenced me growing up more.
Well, we do have an honorable mentions list. Again, on my list was The Big Change, Hulk and Thing, the McFarland with Peter David.
I mean, even Sal Buscema, right? Like, that guy did a monstrous, you know, pun intended there, like, run on the Hulk, like, huge, huge run on the Hulk.
Absolutely.
And, like, guest stars like Mignola and that, when they were these young upstart guys, like, Hulk would be one of the first books everybody worked on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Jason Aaron and Mark Silvestri in recent years had a great, I want to say, a little over a year, maybe a year and a half, that was quite good.
I used to love the annuals. Like, the annuals used to have fun stuff in there.
Oh, yeah, especially when, like, four annuals would cross over. The Return of the Defenders.
Like Abomination would show up, or Highlighter Toxic Guy or whatever. Like,
yeah, Kevin Maguire. Whenever Kevin Maguire draws his version of the Hulk, I think it's hilarious. In the Defenders, I think he did with the Justice League Unlimited or International creative team.
Yeah.
And I think he did one of those four-part crossover annuals as well.
There's one other... I know we're kind of probably going on. There's the one Hulk magazine that I wanted to mention too. This number 18, and it's Ron Wilson and Alfredo Alcala. And Alcala, you know, like a master
Swamp Thing artist.
Yeah, and Conan, and he did his own a lot of his own stuff. That was just like phenomenal work, like amazing.
The black and white magazines. Yeah, I think he pretty much touched all those magazines.
Yeah. Yeah, but there's this great issue, this issue 18, and the Hulk ends up on this island, and there's like this old man and his daughter or granddaughter or something, and the old guy's sick, needs a hospital, but they can't get him anywhere. The Hulk decides to like go underwater, like kick the island off the ground, like separate it from the earth, and carry the island underwater to shore, like bring them all, and he's like, it's like kind of a horseshoe-shaped island, so he's like scooping these I don't know, pirates or something in there as well. Like, he just brings it all. He just takes it all to land. Silent. It's a crazy Hulk, story.
Hulk really works with kooky comedy as well. I think during the Stuart Moore, Axel Alonso days, they got Peter Bagg to do the Incorrigible Hulk, I think it was called, the one shot, which was just insane and really funny.
That wasn't the Editor's Month, was it? That's
No, it wasn't. It was during the bankruptcy days.
Oh, okay.
Where they were just like grabbing anyone they could, especially from alternate and Vertigo comics. So yeah, Peter Bagg did both Spider-Man and Hulk. And they were both quite fun and funny. And then again, one of the most delightful Hulks, we've talked about how iconic the Hulk in the Rain is.
Yeah.
James Kolchaka did a short story just for fun on the internet, that was Hulk versus the Rain. And again, I guess it was Axel Alonso, Eric, that was the Hulk editor at the time?
I think so. I think it was.
Okay, yeah, during this bankruptcy period. So he saw this online and he got Kolchaka to submit it for the Incredible Hulk Annual 2001.
Wow.
And I it's the haiku of Hulk stories. It's very short, and it's basically Kolchaka in his very childlike style drawing the childlike Hulk railing against the Rain.
Mm. Wow, that's amazing.
And if you were to sort of distill the Hulk down to his essence, at least that version of the Hulk, I think this captured it perfectly.
How can you not love our misanthropic green jaded giant, you know?
Absolutely.
We've talked about the unfinished runs of John Byrne and what could have been, and the fact that he didn't sort of pick up that story when he came back to it with Ron Garney. And yeah, even then he didn't last too long. I think he lasted 8 or 9 issues when he came back with Ron Garney. The other tragic run is Paul Jenkins, who took Peter David's idea of the multiple personality Hulk and ran with it and introduced the Devil Hulk. And this storyline is kind of known as the Devil Hulk storyline. And it's also the infamous run that introduced the Hulk dogs, which Ang Lee adapted. But yeah, there was a whole buildup, and you got to see glimpses of, and again, this was a retcon on Peter David's id, ego, and super ego, which was wonderful. But he introduced a whole bunch of other potential multiple personalities, which again, have been picked up on by Al Ewing. And the entire time there was the Devil Hulk, like Hannibal Lecter. He was almost like a snake-like Hulk locked away in the depths of Bruce Banner's mind, right, the entire time trying to work his way out. He was trying to, he was very silver-tongued and would constantly be trying to fool one of the Hulks into letting him loose. And of course, Jenkins left the title very abruptly. And yeah, we didn't get to see the conclusion of this. But as a result, Al Ewing takes the multiple personality to the point where it's almost like Crazy Jane in the Doom Patrol.
Hmm.
So yeah, inside we realize the Hulk that this is a little bit of a spoiler for Immortal Hulk, so I'm just warning listeners out there. Have you come across the Devil Hulk yet, Eric?
I don't think so, no. I think I'm on trade 5. I'm on, like, in the 25th issue or so.
Okay, never mind that. Never mind. But yeah, the Devil Hulk is pivotal.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just going to say that, and it's worth going to glance at Paul, even flip through Paul Jenkins' run, just to sort of see where he was going with that, and the fact that he was named Devil Hulk really kind of plays into the supernatural element that Ewing is playing with in his run.
Right, right.
And yeah, now that, and also the Hulks over the years since Peter David, you notice the Hulk's intelligence, shall we say, and aggressiveness has sort of fluctuated. So a lot of these other Hulks that have appeared since Gladiator Hulk, et cetera, are now designated as separate personalities.
Yeah. That was a run that I actually, one of my favorite comic book runs is the Planet Hulk storyline. I love the taking that character that's so powerful, so strong, and is isolated, and now putting him on a completely different planet where he becomes this savior and this protector and finds his place in the world. And the worst thing that could happen is for him to have Banner come out. Like that becomes his worst nightmare instead of the Hulk coming out. And I like the Superman in Exile storyline because it has that similar sort of other world fighting in this war world gladiator style. But the Greg Pak, what he did with that sort of, motif to take the Hulk and do that with him and give him so much reason to want to come back and get vengeance on the people who sent him there.
And that was done a couple of times too, but Greg Pak by far did it the best because there was it the Microverse where Jarella, it was almost like a Conan type world where the Hulk could run, you know, cut loose.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a sort of sword and sorcery with a, he had a green girlfriend, like a beautiful green girlfriend with blonde hair. And then the Joe Fixit run as well was the Hulk establishing a life for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And Bruce Banner, you know, deathly afraid that Bruce Banner would disrupt it.
Yeah. Yeah. And when, every time he, you know, the blood of the Hulk would give life to the planet. Like it was such an interesting thing that he did with it. So that one, just in general, not just as a Hulk story, but in general in all of comics, I love the Planet Hulk storyline. It really, it's a sweet spot for me. Gentlemen, we've been doing this for 2 hours and 15 minutes. We love the Hulk. I'm gonna have to wrap this one up, and I appreciate you guys giving me so much content, things to read, And I'm really looking forward to us getting together to talk about the Al Ewing run when it's all completed. That'll be a good discussion. Maybe we'll do a two-parter for that.
I have theories on where it's going, but yeah, it's great.
It's fantastic.
This was great.
Fun.
Always a blast chatting with you guys, especially when it's to wax rhapsodic about our favorite things. The frivolous stuff to talk about, really, it does make a big difference in, you know, that happy space in our minds. This is important stuff to do. As silly as people think it is to talk about comics, it is it's very healthy in a way. So I appreciate you guys keeping me company and doing this with me. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks for having me,
Eric.
Absolutely, guys. Well, you guys take care, stay healthy, and let's plan next time we see each other to actually see each other. That'll be
vote Hulk for president.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
but hopefully not the Maestro version. Thank you, everybody.
The Gladiator version.
Thank you, everybody. Thanks for listening, Eric. And stay tuned for more episodes from the Cave of Solitude, and look out for Cauldron. Don't forget to support the Kickstarters as well, everybody. Take care.
Thank you very much.